Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello there and welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. Having killed the leaders of both Hezbollah and this week Hamas, Israel remains apparently committed to destroying the two organisations, what Iran describes as parts of its axis of resistance. This commitment has been demonstrated again throughout Saturday in both Gaza and in Lebanon, even though senior Israeli political and military figures have questioned whether the objective is truly achievable. Sirens in the coastal city of Haifa in northern Israel as rockets fired from Lebanon were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome defences. Israel itself carried out at least 8 airstrikes against the Lebanese capital, Beirut. 280 kilometres further south in Gaza, Israeli planes dropped leaflets showing a picture of the dead Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar with the message, "Hamas will no longer rule Gaza," echoing words expressed by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Overnight Friday into Saturday, an airstrike on Jabalia, the largest refugee camp in the Palestinian territory. Sam Rose from UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, told me earlier the conditions were catastrophic.
The situation here is dire and it's getting worse in terms of the ability of aid agencies to meet the basic life-saving needs for a population who are in desperate need, facing catastrophic food insecurity.
The official Palestinian news agency says an Israeli strike on the Al-Makhazi camp in central Gaza killed at least 11 people in one home. Others are missing, possibly buried in the rubble. Residents described the moment of the strike.
We were sleeping at night when a rocket fell down on this building. They were all shredded to pieces. There are still 4 bodies under the rubble, and we can't pull them out. We don't have the capacity, nor does the civil defence, to pull them out. We work with our hands. We've been working since last night to pull out the bodies.
In the north of Gaza, Israel insists Jabalia contains Hamas fighters. Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus is a spokesman for the Israeli Defence Forces. He told me the IDF tried to persuade civilians to leave and is doing its best to protect those who remain.
Israeli troops, I just spoke with one of the commanders on the ground, constantly brief soldiers on the ground to be aware of their obligation under international law only to engage military combatants, to use distinction between combatant and non-combatant, to use proportionality in the use of force so that there's a minimal risk for hitting civilians. Israeli troops continue to do that. I know that the results may not be perfect, and that is sad and regrettable, but the reason for civilians getting killed is because Hamas is fighting from where the civilians are, and they're using them as human shields.
The war, of course, started with the Hamas attack on southern Israel a little over a year ago, followed a day later by Hezbollah launching rockets into northern Israel. The latest salvo from Lebanon was particularly concerning for the Israelis, with one man killed and at least 9 wounded. A separate drone strike reportedly targeted Benjamin Netanyahu's home in the coastal city of Caesarea. 2 drones were intercepted, only 1 got through. There were no injuries, and Israel says the Prime Minister wasn't even there at the time. These Caesarea residents gave their reaction to the attack.
I feel, as a resident, unsafe, like I've never felt before in Israel. Israel has known wars like everyone's here.
It was troublesome, but then this is not the first time. They've had some success with the drones hitting us without sirens, low flying, and it's something that we're going to have to learn to deal with going ahead.
A video of Mr. Netanyahu looking relaxed and sporting sunglasses was later released, reacting to the attack.
2 days ago, we took out Yahya Sinwar, the terrorist mastermind, whose goons beheaded our men, raped our women, burnt babies alive. We took him out, and we're continuing our battle with Iran's other terrorist proxies. We're going to win this war.
Well, our Middle East regional editor Sebastian Usher came into the NewsHour studio a short time ago and reflected on the latest from Lebanon and Gaza.
Well, what we've seen today in Gaza, we've seen the continuation of Israel's siege of the Jabalia refugee camp. There was a strike that happened around about 24 hours ago now, which Palestinian health officials say killed more than 30 people. But what we've been hearing from there is from medics and residents that the hospitals have been surrounded, that supplies are running out there. The situation is getting more and more desperate. This has been going on for 2 weeks now. So no real change there, despite the killing of Yahya Sinwar a few days ago. There's been no let up. And in Lebanon, we've seen Hezbollah. Now, they haven't said that they carried out this attack, which I think is interesting in itself, but there was a drone which appeared to target the private home of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That's what his office says. Now, he wasn't there. His family wasn't there. We've been waiting quite a long time for statements from Mr. Netanyahu, from Israeli officials, but they have now come. And I think, as one might have expected, they've raised the stakes through this on Israel's confrontation with Iran. Mr. Netanyahu has said that these were essentially agents of Iran who tried to assassinate him and his family. And his foreign minister said almost the identical thing. So, you know, that clearly, rhetorically, is pointing the finger, not at Hezbollah specifically, but at Iran. That, of course, is in the context of the anticipation that's been building ever since Iran launched its ballistic missile attack on Israel back at the start of October, the likely Israeli response. That could now be more severe than perhaps people were expecting in the light of this attack.
Has anyone yet said, look, we're going to retaliate not just for what you did, but now because you've targeted our leader, which is a provocation?
I think that's the implication, certainly in the rhetoric that we've heard from the Israeli Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister. They haven't explicitly said that. There have been reports in the Israeli media quoting unnamed officials saying that this is likely to be the case, that Israel, which obviously has been in discussions with its allies, the US in particular, about what it will do, how it will target Iran, it certainly said that it would be more severe than it was last time, but a sense that it might still moderate to some extent the targets it goes after in order to prevent a further escalation in that conflict. That might now change.
This will add to the headaches facing US Secretary of State Antony Blinken as he returns to Israel for yet another visit, still with the objective set by President Biden that, and indeed confirmed by other leaders when President Biden met them in Europe on Friday, that they want a ceasefire. And they actually seem to perceive the killing of Sinwar as a potential opportunity now to advance that, given that he was one of the blockages to a deal.
Oh, there's definitely been a concerted effort by the US. We've heard from President Biden. We've heard from the Vice President, Kamala Harris. We've heard from the Defense Secretary as well, Lloyd Austin, all singing from the same hymn sheet that this is an opportunity, the killing of Yahya Sinwar, essentially for this famous exit ramp for Israel and Hamas to take to try to end the war in Gaza. Also heard from Germany, from France, from the UK, again, all sending that same message. There's no doubt that Blinken will be coming with that message, but I mean, he's visited the region, I can't even count how many times now, but it's into double figures since October the 7th. Again and again, with a message of moderation for the Israeli leadership, a message which actually has been echoed again by the Defense Secretary in the US, Lloyd Austin, this time about Israel's attacks on Hezbollah in the southern suburbs of Beirut, asking if they can be reined in, if they can be limited. But, I mean, this has fallen on deaf ears, and I think that the Israeli government, Mr. Netanyahu, really will feel that the wind is behind them at the moment, that the momentum is there, that the killing of Sinwar, before that the head of Hamas, Nasrallah, that there's been a number of successes, big, big successes that they've scored recently, which justifies what Mr. Netanyahu has been saying all along, that this is the only strategy that should be undertaken in Gaza and with Hezbollah, which is conflict rather than negotiation until those two groups are essentially defeated.
BBC Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher. There is rightfully a great deal of focus, in particular in France and the UK, on the number of people dying in attempts to cross the narrow strip of water which separates the two countries as they try to illegally land in Britain, often in wholly inadequate dinghies. There are, though, also legal battles taking place in French courts where those alleged to be running the smuggling operations are being brought to justice. Andrew Harding has been in the city of Lille in northern France to follow the biggest cross-channel human trafficking case of recent years.
21 alleged people smugglers, one big gang accused of transporting people illegally from Europe across the channel to the UK. The accused, mostly Iraqi Kurds, one French woman, one Polish man. Okay, we're going into the courtroom now.
This is the biggest cross-channel smuggling case to come to trial. The prosecution is asking for the ringleader to get 15 years in prison. But will that act as a deterrent? In court, the prosecution calls the accused merchants of death, a callous gang making 60,000 euros in profit from each overloaded boat that it launched into the channel. We weren't allowed to talk to those leading this case, but we did get a rare interview with a different French prosecutor, head of the Regional Court of Appeal, Pascal Marconville, a man with huge experience in prosecuting smugglers.
En matière d'immigration clandestine, en tout cas, tout ce qu'on est confronté, moi, je dis toujours aux policiers, c'est comme aux échecs, ils ont les 20 avant d'aller voir.
It's like chess, and the smugglers are always one step ahead of us. We must adapt. The smugglers operate just like drug gangs. The action taken by French police, supported by investigative judges, is designed not only to thwart the smugglers, but to make their operations so expensive that they lose their appeal.
A sensible strategy, perhaps, but is it working?
During a break in the trial, we've come to a nearby cafe to talk to one of the defence lawyers.
My name is Kamel Abbas, and I'm a French lawyer from Lille Bar Association.
And you're defending some of these alleged smugglers?
Exactly, exactly.
You've been covering these sort of cases for a long time.
Oui, j'ai eu plusieurs dossiers de migrants, effectivement.
And how have things changed over the years? And the punishment that the state's demanding?
Les peines sont beaucoup plus lourdes. Ça, c'est une évidence.
The sentences have become a lot heavier, that's clear, he says. 15 years for some. Before that, they were just set free. So the legal framework is getting much tougher, and I think it will continue to do so.
Je pense qu'elle va encore durcir.
And do you think that's sensible? Do you think that will help discourage people from getting involved in
non.
smuggling?
Non. Malheureusement, il n'y a rien qui décourage les gens.
No. There are some who put money above all things. So for them, prison sentences are just a bump in the road. As for this trial, so big it's generated 67 tons of paperwork, it's due to end with verdicts and sentencing in early November.
That's Andrew Harding in Lille, France, reporting for NewsHour here on the BBC World Service. Stay with us. And coming up, we'll hear from one of Italy's last cantastori, the Wandering Storytellers.
I have always sung stories of people who've suffered from hunger or other issues, people's pain. There's a story I wrote about a teenager who I knew in real life.
Rosa viva 15 anni, era figlia di un dottore, era bella veramente.
More of that later. Our headlines, Israel's Prime Minister has accused Hezbollah of trying to assassinate him after his home is targeted by a drone from Lebanon. US unions say a tentative deal has been reached to end a crippling five-week strike at the plane maker Boeing. And a total power blackout continues in Cuba after an overnight attempt to restart the grid failed. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Now, with the US presidential election just a few weeks away, Kamala Harris has been trying to shore up support from a key voting bloc, black men. According to recent polling, the group isn't breaking for her as strongly as it did for Joe Biden in the previous presidential election 4 years ago in 2020. That could have a real impact in places like the key state of Georgia, which has the largest population of black voters of any swing state in the country. The BBC's Nada Torfik has travelled to Savannah in Chatham County.
It's been a long time since Savannah, with its antebellum architecture and centuries-old oak trees covered in Spanish moss, has been a priority for a Democratic candidate for president. But with Georgia as one of the biggest prizes of this election, the way to win this swing state may just be through suburban and rural areas here in the Southeast.
As president, Kamala Harris will continue the fight.
Voters have been bombarded with ads. Kamala Harris is ramping up efforts even more to sway one key group.
It sounds like it's mixed well into the beat.
At the recording studio, Straight Fire Entertainment, I spoke with a group of black men who have no plans to vote for Kamala Harris. Her Good Vibes campaign hasn't reversed a worrying trend of young black men abandoning Democrats.
We vote, people promise, and we never get anything.
43-year-old John Pierre tells me his family will vote for Kamala Harris, but he's decided not to vote at all. His business is suffering as customers struggle to afford studio time.
We've seen what the economy's been like under Biden and Kamala. We've seen what the economy's been like under Trump. Right now, I'm just not sold on anybody.
Every day has been a 9-to-5.
His friend, 35-year-old Ben Adams, also known as DJ Protocol, is all in for Donald Trump, who he says shares the very qualities he admires in his father.
Very blunt, very brash, very straightforward. They say they're going to do something, they go figure out a way to get it done. That, to me, reminds me of, you know, they call it toxic masculinity now, but to me, it's just straight up masculinity. It's straight manhood. I'm going to go out and I'm going to do what I need to do for my family.
To stem Donald Trump's potential gains here, Democrats have dispatched their heavyweights.
Good afternoon, Savannah!
Kamala Harris became the first nominee to visit this county since the 90s.
If you show up, as you did in 2020,
Bill Clinton was sent out to shore up the rural vote in the Southeast, and Barack Obama had this direct message to black men thinking of sitting out the election.
You just aren't feeling the idea of having a woman as president.
Cut your cell phones off and pull your driver's license and your ID out, please.
Well, there's been a steady stream of people coming here to cast their ballots early at this library in Savannah, and there's even more pressure on the candidates to get their message out. Kamala Harris is expected to carry a majority of black Americans who make up a third of the electorate in this state, but her numbers with young black men could have an outsized impact. Her campaign has responded in the last few days by promising them more economic opportunities and by launching a tour across historically black colleges. At Georgia's oldest public historically black college, Savannah State, the marching band is practicing for the yearly homecoming celebration. Many of these students say Kamala Harris will get their vote, but not because of her race.
Being that Kamala is an African-American woman, that does not just particularly sway me to just go with Kamala because she's black. I just really want to understand who actually cares.
In an election this close, this once loyal voting base is keeping Democrats on their toes.
Now to Torfik reporting. Do stay with us because in 15 minutes we'll hear from two undecided voters, one in Georgia, one in Pennsylvania. And I'll also be asking why Elon Musk has made up his mind for Donald Trump. This is NewsHour from the BBC. Now, let us move on to an experience I had in this studio, or in one of our studios, a few hours ago. Hot sauce is a food fad that seems here to stay. Celebrities, including Ed Sheeran and Brooklyn Beckham, are marketing their own recipes. There's a hit show online in which famous people are interviewed as they sample ever hotter condiments. Now, I've a confession to make. I'm a hot sauce virgin, or at least I was, until Jen Ferguson of online retailer Hot Burns and Black came into the studio last night with a selection of her wares. I asked her first, had she seen evidence that hot sauces are, well, hot?
Absolutely. So we have seen just phenomenal sales. We've been in this business. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary next month. So we've had 10 years of slinging hot sauce. And we, yeah, last year saw 94% sales increase for hot sauces. Christmas time was 150% up on 2022. And this year shows no sign of slowing either. We're looking at 35%, I think, so far. So, yeah, it's going a bit crazy.
Now, you've brought in three bottles for me to try. This one first is called Deptford. Is this a mild one? I hope it's a mild one to start with.
I think my palate's probably a little bit jaded. For me, it's not that mild. Sorry, not that hot, but you can be the judge of that.
Right, hang on. It's a very, it's a sort of orangey colour. Hang on a second. We put it on a crisp. No, that's hot. That's hot. It's not too hot, you're right. It's not too hot.
It's not too hot, and I think the chilies that it uses, it's yellow habaneros, so the heat is immediate, but it kind of subsides quite quickly. And you've got a lot of fruit in there as well. So you've got passion fruit, you've got pineapple, you've got mango. And the sweetness tempers the heat a wee bit. So it's a kind of quite a horribly named trend called swicy, a nasty portmanteau of sweet and spicy. So I didn't make that up. You'll find...
Next one. Now... This is Jock's hot sauce. I'm tempted to ask who Jock is, but this is not as mild. This is a darker colour. I mean, one quick thing I ask you while I try this one is, there's a risk, isn't there, with hot sauces that we're just losing our palate for flavours?
Possibly. I think we sell a lot of super hot sauces, but I think for the most part, people...
Limey. Sorry.
I'm enjoying
it. Carry on.
Yeah, I think for the most part, people want sauces that are full of flavour, medium heat, that they're not going to be destroyed after a couple of drops. They want something they can sling over their meals, something that's versatile, adding a little bit of flavour.
I'm going to need a slurp of water at this point, Jen. Hang on. Let me say about that one that was just, that's still in the back of my throat. And so I'm slightly hesitant with this last one because you did warn me. There's a scale for heat. This last one, which is called Experience with a capital X, where is it on the scale of heat?
So this one sits at number 10. If you've ever seen the YouTube series Hot Ones, where celebrities eat 10 sauces ranging in heat, this is the last one. It's called The Last Dab, and this is a lot of sauce you're putting on that crisp there, Sean. So it's called The Last Dab, and it may be the last thing we ever hear from Sean.
You said there's a kind of thousand, and that's 2 million on this scale.
That is 2 million plus.
Oh, I think this is the one. I may still be tasting this at breakfast tomorrow. Jen, last word. Do you think the celebrities, are they making a difference to these sales?
I think the Hot Ones show certainly is. Whether Brooklyn Beckham is going to have a career in hot sauce making, I don't know.
The end of my tongue feels like it's on fire. I should say it did take a very, very lot of milk last night to soothe that effect on my tongue and my lips, which eventually stopped burning. There was a little bit of a pain in my stomach for a while afterwards. But I have to say, thanks to Jen Ferguson of online retailer Hope Burns and Black, I think. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to News Hour. In the days when news travelled slowly rather than simultaneously around the world, some Italian communities would rely on cantastori, wandering story singers, known by some in other countries as troubadours. They'd write and perform songs about everyday struggles or about shocking events. Adriano Urbano has travelled to Sicily to meet one of the country's last cantastori.
This is Ballarò, one of Italy's oldest markets, right in the centre of Palermo, Sicily's capital city. Here, sellers flog fruit juice,
prego ragazzi, arancia, un euro,
or invite you to sample street food.
Prova la panella.
But there is one voice you will no longer find, that of the cantastorie, story singers, who would travel around performing their own songs about what was going on in the world. Among them is Nonno Salamone, one of the last cantastorie left. He is described as a living treasure by the region's official heritage register. To meet him, I travel to the village of Sutera, over 60 miles into Sicily's rural heartland. At 79, he has seen the tradition evolve.
The first modern cantastorie was likely Ciccio Busacca, who travelled all the way to central Italy. He would sit on the top of his car, prop up the boards with pictures illustrating the story, and he would sing. I have always sung stories of people who've suffered from hunger or other issues, people's pain. There's a story I wrote about a teenager who I knew in real life.
Rosa viva 15 anni, era figlia di un dottore, era bella veramente.
Rosa falls pregnant and is kicked out of her home. She finds people who force her on the streets as a prostitute and lead her to drugs. She dies.
Ma Rosa, 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 donne vai? Ma Rosa, 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 resta qua.
The cantastorie also keep history alive. Take The Train of the Sun, Lo Treno dello Sole, written by poet Ignazio Buttitta.
Delle braccia essa bruciava, na na na.
It's the Marcinelli tragedy. A wife learns many Italians have died in a mine in Belgium, including her husband.
Today, his performances are rare and limited to local festivals, but the news is still fueling his defining mission as a cantastorie, pointing the finger at injustice. We part ways with the story of a young football fan terrified by bombings.
It's the story of a child who crosses the Mediterranean in a dinghy because of so-called humanitarian bombs.
Adriana Urbano in Sicily with a cantastoria, wandering with his news. And you're listening to the Sedentary Storytellers at NewsHour from the BBC. Welcome back to BBC NewsHour with me, Sean Lay. With fewer than 3 weeks to go until the election of Joe Biden's successor as US president, the contest is displaying ever more signs of going down to the wire. Statistically inseparable from one another, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump will know how dependent their fate is on the relatively small number of undecided voters in a handful of states. One thing that might make a difference is money. Kamala Harris has an edge in financial support. Donald Trump, whose own wealth is contested, has one important, very rich friend, Elon Musk. It helps to earn him a place as a sort of warm-up man for the candidate. Here he is on Thursday at a town hall event in Folsom, Pennsylvania. He suggested there that the president and vice president were being manipulated.
The dude's like barely got two functional neurons, so, you know, it's like, and he just seems to be at the beach a lot, and
so
he's obviously not in charge. As far as I can determine, there isn't any one sort of puppet master. It's more like there's 1,000 or, I don't know, a lot. But it's just obvious that Biden's not in charge. It's obvious that Kamala's not in charge. I mean, the Kamala's, they just replaced the Biden puppet with the Kamala puppet, very obviously. And it's, you can tell, like, if the teleprompter stops working, then the puppet breaks. And it's like, oh. The puppet just starts looping because the teleprompter broke.
Elon Musk warming up the crowd for Donald Trump on Thursday. Well, Jessica Piper is an election data and campaigns reporter for Politico. She explained to me the mechanism which Mr. Musk has used to channel $75 million of his own money in support of Donald Trump's campaign.
So in American politics, if you want to spend, you know, almost literally as much money as you would like to, you set up something called a super PAC, which is an organization, a political action committee that can spend unlimited money. There's just a couple of restrictions on coordination with campaigns. But honestly, at this point, those restrictions are relatively minimal. Elon Musk set up a super PAC. He calls it America PAC. And the organization is doing a lot of voter outreach in key states on behalf of former President Donald Trump's campaign. It's not the only group doing this sort of work, but, you know, Musk is relatively new as a political player, spending this much of his own money.
Now, this question of why Elon Musk has got so actively involved in the Trump campaign is an intriguing one, because a lot of business people tend to sort of hold back, don't they, until they know who's won, and then they kind of get involved.
That is certainly true. And that's what we see with a lot of American business leaders who play both sides a little bit or say they're staying out of politics, you know, someone like Mark Zuckerberg. And Elon Musk actually used to be somewhat like that. You know, he used to give money a little bit to Republicans, a little bit to Democrats. And in the past few years, he's really taken a turn, I think, in his own beliefs towards the American right. One of his big companies, Tesla, makes electric vehicles, which in the United States were sort of branded as more associated with the Democratic Party, the party that cared about the environment. One thing that happened when Biden was elected and when he became president was that Joe Biden put a lot in trying to do outreach to companies that have unionized workforces and American car companies that employed union shops. And Musk and Tesla were excluded from those efforts. And I think Musk didn't take too kindly to that.
I'm bound to ask, are Democrats sorry to have lost him and his money and his potential influence? And are all Republicans delighted that he has kind of thrown his lot in so publicly with their party?
I think among some Democrats, particularly those in the tech world, there is some regret. I think Republicans, on the flip side, I think there is a bit of genuinely a mixed opinions about Elon Musk. I think a lot of Republicans certainly welcome his support, but he's also a very polarizing figure. Some Republicans, I think, don't want him to become too influential in the party because he has, you know, his own agenda and his own ideas.
We often hear Donald Trump being described as a transactional politician. You know, what can you do for me? What can Musk do for him? And what might Musk expect in return?
You know, in addition to the money going directly to, you know, voter outreach, Elon Musk also has a persona, right? He's a figure that is popular, not necessarily in a broad sense, but among specific groups of people, particularly, you know, young men. The Trump campaign is hoping that Musk's sort of unique tech bro appeals to certain voters in these states who maybe were less tuned into the election because of Trump, but who think, oh, I really like Elon Musk and he's a Trump guy, so I'll be a Trump guy. And then on the flip side, yeah, Musk has made it clear that he wants to be influential in a future Trump administration. One thing to keep in mind is that members of the president's cabinet have to be confirmed by the Senate. So would Elon Musk be too controversial of a figure for an official cabinet position? I think there's a chance, but there's also certainly ways to be an advisor to the president. Musk expects that he would be influential in some capacity, at least. There's been a lot of incendiary language from Elon Musk, but of course, there's been a lot of incendiary language from Donald Trump, too, at this point. It's not that what Musk is introducing is necessarily new, but it's certainly echoing what Trump has said and what the direction that the Republican Party has taken. I think there are real questions, you know, is this incendiary language appealing to swing voters, to the moderates that the Trump campaign maybe should be trying to win over still? So maybe the language isn't as helpful for winning elections, but Musk is only one of several figures talking like that.
Jessica Piper at Politico. We heard earlier about the Harris campaign's efforts to reach out to African-American men in Georgia. One such voter is Cameron Llewellyn, father of three school-age children, currently looking for a new job in IT. Trump in 2016, Biden in 2020, but yet to make up his mind who to vote for on November the 5th. Lynn Kelleher is also undecided. A registered Republican, a mother of adult children, and a realtor selling property in her home state of Pennsylvania, she too in 2020 abandoned her previous support for Donald Trump, though in her case by voting for a third-party candidate.
I've always kind of held Republican ideals as kind of in line with my thinking, Donald Trump, I despise him. I just don't know that I can vote for that man.
So for those kind of prominent Republicans, people like Dick Cheney, the former vice president, who said they're going to vote for Kamala Harris because they are so revolted by Donald Trump, kind of intellectually, you can't make that jump.
The fact that so many people in his party have come out against him, people who worked with him, weighs heavily. And at this point, I am kind of leaning more towards Kamala, but I just don't know that I can make that leap. I think she's far more liberal than she lets on to be. The border policy is important to me. Her record on that is abysmal. And, you know, the fact that her running mate has and she have advocated for providing illegal immigrants opportunities that should be reserved for citizens, like driver's licenses and all that kind of stuff. I just don't know.
OK, let me bring in Cameron Llewellyn there, who is in Georgia, which is a little bit close to the border. But before we talk about the border question, Cameron, I'm fascinated by your journey. You did vote for Donald Trump in 2016, but as much as anything, that was a protest vote against the way the Democrats had treated Bernie Sanders.
That's right. I am in favor of a meritocracy. I do believe that you actually need to earn the right to govern. Specifically in that election, what I saw is that Bernie Sanders was sort of railroaded. And so my vote in 2016 was as much against the sort of creeping coronation of Hillary as it was a hope that Bernie Sanders would be and represent a new, fresh path forward for the country.
Right. So if Hillary Clinton had a coronation, you'd have to say that kind of even more the case with Kamala Harris.
Yeah, you beat me to it. I understand that it was incredible circumstances that caused Joe Biden to step down. The American public deserved a chance to decide who was going to be the Democratic nominee. And the votes that were cast were for Joe Biden, not for Kamala Harris. And so since we just passed that off, there's a sense that she didn't actually do anything to earn the nomination. And I think you can see that in the most recent outreach, specifically to African-American men, because it seems like it's been pandering toward a demographic that just hasn't really shown up for her.
And I think you say that as an African-American man yourself.
I do. And in fact, I was saying it as far back as when she received it. I said, okay, that if that's what she's going to do, well, you're going to have problems with a voting base that has absolutely no reason to vote for you other than you're saying, hey, I'm black. That's not the way that things should be.
Even allowing for that, it is hard to see how that would make you vote Donald Trump this year, given that you rejected Trump 4 years ago by voting for Joe Biden, Cameron.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of the flip of Lynn, right? I had voted Democratic most of my life. But American exceptionalism is this idea that the American experiment is based on ideas that we are special in the world, and that in order to maintain that special place in the world, we have got to be investing in our own security, as Lynn said, jobs, trying to do that in a way that is egalitarian. Right. And we no longer had that, at least prior to Donald Trump. The irony is that the person that they believe will bring it in is, you know, the only president that's been indicted and had, you know, this many things, including January 6th.
Lynn Kelleher, let me go back to you. What about the issue that a lot of people have said might drive undecided voters into the Harris camp, or at least certainly away from Donald Trump, and that is the question of abortion?
I support the woman's right to choose, but I will be honest and say that while it is really important, it's probably number four in my top three issues, which are the border, the economy, foreign policy. Again, that's another thing that just makes it so difficult for me. I don't think Kamala has the presence or the experience to guide us out of what's become, you know, a world on fire. Mm-hmm. And yet Donald Trump thumps his chest and just thinks that because he says something, it's going to be true, and certainly doesn't understand the nuances of foreign policy.
Right. Let me ask you both a final question. Do you have a message for the political parties about the kind of choices that you've been given?
It just galls me that this is the best we can do. If we were ever going to post a third party candidate, this would have been the year, and it didn't happen.
That's right.
I agree with Cameron that, you know, I will vote. I'm not going to sit home, even though that's what I'd like to do.
One of the things that it feels like is that we're living in a post-truth era, in which the value of shame has been lost, the value of objective truth has been lost. And in the process, we have lost what used to make elections really, really important to the voters, which was policy. And it was amazing to watch the vice presidential debate reaction just because it was civil. So my message is, hey, let's treat the American people like they are the people of old that are capable of doing great things, that they are capable of being informed and making informed decisions. And in doing so, issue policies that actually go forth in a way, in a bold leadership vision to take America into the next millennium. A person who is a father like me wants to know that there's a chance America could be better for my children than it has been for me. And absent real dialogue and real actual leadership, all we have gotten is feckless attempts to earn our nomination through smearing attacks. My concern is that the legacy of Donald Trump will be that we have stopped having civil discussion and we have turned into Facebook politics. And that's not the way that any country is going to survive.
That's Cameron Llewellyn and Lynn Kelleher talking to me here on NewsHour on the BBC World Service with food for thought for the political parties as they wrestle with their conscience over who to vote for on November the 5th in the forthcoming US presidential election. We'll be back shortly. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Georgia's parliamentary election takes place a week today, next Saturday, seen by many as a crucial moment in determining whether the country tilts towards membership of the European Union, which the opposition favours, or closer ties with Russia, the governing party, appears to support. The government's already passed a transparency of foreign agents law. NGOs and independent media, which receive more than one-fifth of funding from foreign donors, have to register as organisations bearing the interest of a foreign power. Ministers say it's protection from foreign influence. Their critics call it the Russian law because President Putin used such a mechanism to effect a crackdown. Among the critics are the community based at Tbilisi's most important techno club, Bassiani, who see themselves as an integral part of political activism in Georgia. How vital is dancing in a country going through the biggest political and social crisis of its generation? Frank McQueenie went to the capital, Tbilisi, to find out.
Just entered Bassiani underneath the city's largest sports arena, a disused public swimming pool around two-thirds of the size of an Olympic pool. I'm told it fits up to 1,200 people. I'm facing the DJ booth and stacks of huge speakers on either side, two rows of four strobe lights hanging from metal chains.
This place itself is very monumental and very brutalistic.
The club staff, event curator and guest performers are rehearsing for tomorrow's party.
The light and the music and everything stucks your mind from the very first second.
I'm with Georgi Kikonishvili, activist, music journalist and founder of this event.
I will never forget the first time when I entered Bassiani. It felt like I was not in Georgia. The level of empathy and the solidarity which I saw, I just realized that I was watching a better version of Georgia on the dance floor. People of my generation, I'm 35 years old, we are the first generation who were born after the breakup of the Soviet Union. We just started to speak about everything which we didn't accept. Politics or religion or sexuality or gay rights or women's rights. It was totally different to what was accepted. Georgia was and still is a very religious country. We felt quite lonely, but then we found each other. You are accepted, you are part of the club, you are a member of the club as long as you share values of freedom, liberty, equality and solidarity.
Georgi says that Bassiani has never shied away from airing its progressive political opinions, even though this directly challenges the conservative ideology prevalent in Georgian society and government.
There has been always a lot of Polish cars. Also, there are some actions from the religious groups. They held a religious ritual in front of Bassiani, actually, because they say that these clubs are the gates to hell.
Georgi introduces me to Natya, contemporary dancer and founder of the experimental arts platform Platza.
Dance and singing, it's very symbolic. You see demonstrations and people are getting together and starting to dance. This is peaceful, ways of express your feelings. We have difficulties with Ministry of Culture, something that they think that you are creating the rebellious new movements they don't really want, so they make you scared. And today many of my friends got censored.
Many of Georgia's cultural figures are convinced that the ministry is on a mission to force loyalty to the government. The Minister of Culture argues their goal is to clear up alleged inefficiency, nepotism and favouritism across various areas of arts and culture. Earlier this year, tens of thousands of people came down to the streets of Tbilisi to protest the new Transparency of Foreign Agents law. In response to the legislation, the EU formally suspended Georgia's accession to the bloc and froze $32 million in financial aid for the country's defense ministry, arguing that the way the law was adopted did not meet European requirements for democratic lawmaking. The demonstrations went on for months and reached unprecedented numbers of 100,000 on several occasions.
It's Georgia Independence Day, celebrations across the country. But it's not just about celebrating today. I'm at Tbilisi Concert Hall, where many people are gathering ahead of today's march. Students, professionals, young, old, waving Georgian and EU flags.
This day marks more than 100 years since Georgia became independent from the Russian Empire. Unfortunately, it only lasted for 3 years. And then the Soviet Union came. Legally, we are independent from Russia now, but still there is a threat of coming back to Russian influence.
I think that the only hope which really is still left is in the elections.
Turnout is expected to be the highest in over a decade, but the outcome is uncertain. The Georgian Dream Party, currently in power, calls itself the Party of Peace, focused on avoiding an unwinnable war with Russia and reminding citizens of the traumatic invasion of 2008 while glossing over its closer ties to Moscow. The opposition says it's about Europe and freedom versus Russia and repression. It's 2 a.m. and I've arrived at Bastiani, where the party is popping off.
I can feel the bass hitting with powerful, visceral force.
The dance floor, it's a natural ecstasy. Not everyone is taking drugs, right?
Nia is a friend of the club since day one.
Every night can be your last night, and nobody knows what will happen tomorrow.
Georgi, it's 7 a.m., so many happy faces. How does it feel for you?
The most emotional part of tonight actually has been when I was watching these performances and these people and music and everything. I was thinking that there is a risk of them taking this away from us, but this emotional bond is so strong that I hope there could be no force which can disconnect us.
Frank McQueeny on those partying on in Georgia. A long-lost short story by the author of Dracula, Bram Stoker, has been rediscovered by an amateur historian. Gibbet Hill was published in the Dublin edition of the Daily Express in 1890. Brian Cleary found a copy at the National Library of Ireland, holding his breath as he realised he could be the first person to read it in more than a century. Gibbet Hill is a ghostly tale written when Stoker was making his initial notes for Dracula. Experts say it sheds light on his development as an author. Speaking at an exhibition in Dublin, Mr. Cleary described finding the story.
I was doing archival research to pass the time in the National Library of Ireland, and during that process, which took me several weeks, I found an advert for this story, and I read the words Gibbet Hill, and I knew that that wasn't a Bram Stoker story that I'd ever heard of in any of the biographies or bibliographies, and I was just astounded, flabbergasted.
And I just need to bring you, in the closing moments of NewsHour, an update of a breaking story. Reports from an Israeli strike on Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. Hamas-affiliated media report casualties. Some suggest at least 60 people have been killed. There's been no comment from Israel so far. Thank you very much for your company this hour. I'm Sean Lay with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us for more news throughout the coming hours.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.